Hi, and welcome back to the fourth annual conference for Moms Fighting Autism. I'm very excited to have with us today Stephanie McGurr. She is a nutritionist She's a dietary consultant for autism and ADHD. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, today I'm going to be talking about the myths versus reality of what the autism diet really is and then how we can manage the change. Just a quick background, I founded the website nourishingjourney.com so that I can help parents of children with autism and ADHD learn more about dietary changes and not only learn what they are, but really manage it. Because you might get the diagnosis from your doctor or from a nutritionist or a doctor who's aware of nutritional interventions, and you might have a plan of what you're supposed to do, but then you go home and you're stuck and you're there, and it's all up to you to manage the diet and this huge transition all on your own. And so that's kind of where I step in and where I hope to be of benefit and of service to the parents in the autism community. So the first myth that I'd like to talk to you about today is that autism only involves the brain and neurological system. In actuality, it's the gut and the brain, and they're connected. Scientists are continually learning more about the gut-brain connection, and they've actually named this the second brain in the digestive tract. And it's our enteric nervous system, which developed from the very same embryonic tissue as our central nervous system, which is the brain and spinal cord, the one that everybody thinks about when you talk about the nervous system. And there are actually more pain receptors in the gut than in the brain. And have you ever experienced an emotion with gut reactions like butterflies, nausea, or aches related to nervousness, stress, or other emotions? That's your second brain. And in fact, 90 to 95% of the body's serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, is in the gut itself. The serotonin that is housed in the gut is acting like a neurotransmitter that sends messages between nerve cells, and that helps regulate our mood, sleep, learning, and can influence our state of well-being. And because of this connection, a lot of what happens with the digestion affects the nervous system, and it contributes to a variety of neurological conditions. So autism is definitely not only involving the neurological system in the brain. The second myth is that dietary changes only help with digestive-related conditions. Well, just like autism does not only affect the neurological system, dietary changes affect much more than digestive-related conditions. When the digestive system is not functioning at its optimum level, the nutrients aren't properly digested or absorbed from the food, and this leads to further nutritional imbalances and related disorders. And in fact, poor digestion can incur because of a variety of issues like inflammation, toxins, pathogens, antibiotics, poor gut flora, too much bad bacteria, yeast, parasites, or fungi, in combination with too little of the good bacteria, the stuff that we need in there as part of our digestion. And all of this leads to leaky gut, which is a term that literally means things are being absorbed into the bloodstream from inside the intestines or digestive tract or gut, which are used interchangeably. And these things shouldn't be absorbed into the bloodstream. And these things are like improperly digested proteins or toxins from digestive waste. Those things should not get into your bloodstream and into your body. Those should be contained to the digestive system so that they can be eliminated. But these interact with our other body systems when they do get into the blood, like the neurological system and the receptors in the brain, which can cause seemingly unrelated issues and symptoms unrelated to digestion. And an analogy for the leaky gut is an insect screen on a window. Normally that screen keeps out all the bugs and things that you don't want to come in, but it lets air through. It does its job. But if there's a hole, even a small hole, bugs and insects can find their way inside through that screen. And in the same way, things that do not belong into our blood find their way into the bloodstream when there are holes in the digestive tract. Now, removing these offending triggers and adding the extra nutrients and good bacteria, which actually work to plug those holes if there's already damage in the digestive lining, doing these things works to reverse the effects of leaky gut. And the third myth is that there's one single autism diet or a one-size-fits-all solution. But there is actually a variety of diets that help in different ways. And I'm going to go through these very quickly, but what I'd really like to discuss and focus on today is a healthy diet, and specifically the GF-CF-SF diet. And we'll come back to those after we go through this list pretty quickly. Now, the healthy diet should be the foundation of everyone's diet, regardless of the diagnosis, age, or any kind of medical condition. And the first autism-specific diet that can be of help is the GF-CF-SF, or gluten-free, casein-free, and soy-free. Now, this one is usually the easiest to implement and the most commonly tried dietary change, which is why it's the most often talked about. And we'll discuss more pretty soon. Right now, we're going to move on to the Feingold diet, which is sometimes called the fail-safe, low-phenol, or low-salicylate diet. And in this diet, there's no artificial ingredients, and they also avoid high salicylates or phenolic foods. And these are naturally occurring compounds in regular fruits and vegetables. The other option is the BED, or body ecology diet, and this one focuses on getting rid of yeast. So you have no sugar at all, and it's to control the yeast overgrowth within the body. This one uses fermented foods and special food combining rules to reduce the amount of yeast in the body. The next diet is the SCD, or specific carbohydrate diet, or a similar diet called GAPS, gut and psychology syndrome diet. These limit carbohydrates to fruit and non-starchy vegetables, but it allows honey, and it doesn't allow certain other types of sugars, which are chemically called double sugars, so no lactose, maltose, or sucrose, and those are specifics to that particular diet type. And another diet is the rotation diet. So this is based on specific groups or families of food, and you would rotate each family of food on a 4-day rotation plan. And this is intended to reduce sensitivities to that happen because of frequent eating of the same foods repetitively, which sometimes increases sensitivities. So if you rotate foods regularly, in theory, this will reduce their sensitivity. The next diet is the broad elimination diet. And this is actually the same thing as the GF-CF-SF, but on a larger scale. The GF-CF-SF diet reduces or eliminates only those three items. But this one would help you detect other food sensitivities or intolerances beyond just the gluten-free, casein-free, soy-free. And it helps with a very long list of health symptoms beyond autism. And actually, it's hard to believe with this list, but there are many other dietary options and specific plans that you could try to follow. Now, they all focus on healing the gut and dealing with food sensitivities in one way or another. It's just in different combinations. And detective work is necessary to find out what is best for your child. And like I said, most people start with the gluten-free, casein-free, soy-free diet and then move on from there if they feel like they're still missing a piece of the puzzle. So the next myth is myth number 4, and it's all about, the myth is that it's all about what you can't eat, and I would really, really like to just eliminate this myth altogether because your focus should be on what you can eat and not what you cannot eat. You want to focus on what you should have on in your diet. The eliminated foods are very important because regressions will happen if you miss something, but it shouldn't be your only focus. You don't want to switch from junk foods or the standard American diet, which they call SAD, to GF-CF-SF junk. You want to think nutrients. Think every bite counts. How many nutrients can I pack into each meal? And by getting started with a healthy diet foundation, you can work up from there with your specific dietary choices related to autism. But if we focus on the healthy diet foundation, you want to start with the good. Always think about the positive, what you should be eating. And in this list would include raw fruits, veggies, nuts, and seeds because they are very nutrient dense. A lot of vitamins and minerals and replacement for calcium and high protein in these as well. There's the raw fats that are very important. Omega-3s are essential for proper brain function. Greens, so these are your green leafy vegetables. I separated those out from the veggies because these are especially high in calcium and mineral content, which is good if you're following a dairy-free diet. And you want to think about the supplements that you need. If your child has nutrient deficiencies, then you want to think about supplements like B vitamins, zinc, calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, and so on. Also is probiotics. I mentioned the leaky gut and the bacteria and the flora of the digestive tract. Probiotics are the good bacteria. You want these. You need more of these. You need to heal your gut with the probiotics, and those are essential to supplement with. Another item is digestive enzymes, and these will help reduce the effects of accidental ingestion of gluten, dairy, or soy when it happens, as well as heal the digestive tract and improve digestion and nutrient absorption. And as well, with some of the diets that I mentioned include fermented foods and drinks, and these are also beneficial if you want to start trying those out. Now, while you're focusing on the good, you should also be eliminating the bad. And this is what's not best for you and what you should work towards replacing and eliminating altogether, regardless of your diagnosis, regardless of your health. Most of these don't even belong in our food supply. But somehow in our modern world, we've just that's where we are today. So the things that you want to think about eliminating are artificial additives, colorings, flavorings, and preservatives, artificial sweeteners, MSG, GMOs, sodas, including the diet because of the artificial sweeteners, and regular sodas, trans or hydrogenated fats, HFCS, which is high fructose corn syrup, a sugar alternative in most processed foods, refined sugar. That can be replaced with stevia and coconut sugar, which are a better alternative, pesticides, processed foods in a box. Heated fats, you want to try to replace those with extra virgin olive oil or coconut oil for cooking. And any known allergens or food sensitivities that you might have been tested for or confirmed with an elimination diet, or that you're trying out for an elimination diet, such as the gluten-free, casein-free, soy-free diet. So let's talk about that one. Myth number 5. The myth is that this diet is anecdotal without any real scientific basis. Now, while this might not have been studied on a large scale yet because the pharmaceutical industry can't benefit from this study, so they're not funding it because there is no medicine that they can sell to replace the diet. The funding isn't there for studies, but the evidence is beyond anecdotal. The diet is beneficial to people with autism because of a damaged digestive system and its improperly broken down proteins. It's all about the protein. The gluten is protein in certain grains. Casein is the protein in milk and dairy products from animal sources. Lactose is a milk sugar, not a protein. I wanted to point that out. So that's a completely different intolerance factor. Lactose-free milk is not the same thing as following a casein-free diet. And soy, of course, refers to the protein component of the soy and not the soy products. Now, I'll give you a mini biology lesson here, and I hope to make it easy to understand by using an analogy. Proteins are chains of amino acids that can be up to 20,000 amino acids long. And if you imagine a pearl necklace, the amino acids are the single pearls on the necklace. And a small chain of amino acids, perhaps a pearl bracelet, is called a peptide. And those are bonded together in a short chain. Many peptides together form the long chain protein, and they have a molecular bonds that cause the chain to fold up on itself, kind of like a tangled necklace. That's the full structure of the protein. So when you're eating and when you're ingesting proteins of all varieties, your body has to break down that complicated structure and get it down back into the single amino acids to be able to use them for your body's needs. So when you digest that protein, it does the body breaks it down into pieces. First, it takes apart that tangled necklace, similar to smaller bracelets called peptides. From there, it can then break the peptides down into single amino acids. And this all happens just fine with the healthy digestive system. But the problem is, when you have a leaky gut, larger food pieces that should not go through the intestines and into the bloodstream are getting through. This is that fly on the screen analogy. This means that these bracelets or peptides are getting into the bloodstream when they shouldn't. And those peptides can have one of two different effects in the bloodstream. They can either stimulate an autoimmune system reaction, causing allergic responses to these foods, or that can literally act as opioid compounds when crossing into the brain. They're structurally similar to those neurotransmitters, and they attach themselves to opiate receptors in the brain. This contributes to the craving effect of eating foods. So like a drug, people who are sensitive to these foods often crave them and consume them in a large quantity in the diet, which is why parents of children with autism often say, my child will only eat breads and crackers and cheeses and macaroni and cheese and chicken nuggets and everything that's breaded anything with cheese with it as well. These things actually have a drug-like effect within the body. Now, let's talk a moment about the gluten-free, casein-free, soy-free diet details. That's a mouthful. If you want to go gluten-free, casein-free, soy-free, there is a few things that you need to know. And I realize I'm going very fast through all of this tonight. I believe it's actually already online. I hope it is. And this PDF file should be already available for download. So you can download this out and print it out and not have to worry about rushing through keeping notes. You can actually have a copy of this for your own resources. Now, the gluten-free diet is no wheat, barley, rye, spelt, kamut, or oats. And there's an asterisk by the oats because oats themselves don't have gluten in them, but they're often grown in alternating years in wheat fields, or they're processed with gluten-containing grains in those processing facilities. Because of that, they're highly contaminated with gluten. If you want to use oats, you must use a gluten-free certified oat. So also, wheat-free is not gluten-free. Beware of the wheat-free label. You want to make sure your foods are gluten-free entirely. And other things to be aware of are hidden sources of gluten, such as hydrolyzed vegetable protein or plant protein, dextrin malts, MSG, soy sauces, ketchup, and other condiments that may have hidden gluten, Play-Doh, which hopefully we're not eating, but children who put their hands in their mouths often can get the Play-Doh in their mouths and therefore into the digestive system. And you need to find alternative sources of Play-Doh. Accidental gluten ingestion can set you back for days or possibly weeks if the symptoms are more severe. So this is something that you really do need to be careful about. For the dairy and the soy won't have such a strong reaction or such a long reaction because your body gets rid of it faster. But with all of these, accidental ingestion can cause a regression. Another issue is, or something to think about, is good grain substitutes. If you can't have wheat, barley, rye, and all of these other grains, oats, what are you going to eat? Well, some other alternatives are quinoa, rice, amaranth, and buckwheat, and there are more. This is just a short list for the sake of time. And there are also flours for baking that can be made. You can make them yourself by combining your own GFCF SF flours, or you can buy purchased mixes in stores. And with the GF product series growing consistently, there are many more options now than we used to have. So you can search online for recipes or your local store for alternative baking ingredients. Moving on to casein or dairy-free foods. Casein is the protein found in milk products from animals, cows, goats, sheep, etc. You want to consider all milk products, not just milk itself. Cream, yogurt, half and half, ice cream, cheeses, all types of butter, condensed milk, dry milk powder. All of these products still contain the dairy protein component of casein. Milk-free is not necessarily casein-free. So beware of partial milk ingredients like whey, caseinate, lactose, butter flavor, and so on. Now, on the other hand, there are some safe-sounding there are some safe ingredients that have a milk-like sound to the name. Calcium lactate, cocoa butter, cream of tartar, lactic acid. These types of words have nothing to do with calcium, with casein or milk. So these are things, words, it's a new vocabulary that you have to learn when you start out these diets. Good substitutes for milk are almond, hemp, rice, and coconut milk, as well as the products that you can make from them. And on the issue of being soy-free, soy has many other health detriments besides just being part of the autism diet because of the way the body breaks down the protein. Soy is highly estrogenic, which is the female hormones. It's genetically modified. It's a goitrogen, which means that it blocks thyroid hormone synthesis. So there are many other ways that health that soy is actually not good for our health. Soybeans are also called edamame. They're found in soy oil, miso, soy sauce, tamari, tempeh, tempura, tofu, and all of the Asian-related products that you find in typical Asian food stores or restaurants. And these tamari is actually a gluten-free soy sauce, and I'd like to mention this because many people, when they're just going gluten and dairy-free, they'll use tamari as a replacement for soy sauce. And that's okay, but if you're including soy-free in your diet, then tamari has to be eliminated as well. Hidden sources of soy are lecithin, soy lecithin. Sometimes it's just labeled as lecithin, and you don't know which product, plant product it's coming from. HVP is, again, hydrolyzed vegetable protein. Mono and diglycerides could be a code word for soy-containing ingredients. MSG and vitamin E. Not all vitamin E comes from a soy source, so check your sources in the particular products that you're using if it has vitamin E. And soy is found in almost all processed and packaged foods with these hidden sources and those code words. So be careful if you're still using processed foods. The sixth myth, moving forward here, is that everyone has the same experience or sees the same results. And this is entirely untrue. You must give time for the changes to work, and it's not instant. Everybody sees their results differently, just as your child has different autism symptoms than another autistic child. And the diet, it works for different reasons depending on what foods you're sensitive to. You will see different results in a different way than other people might see their results. So don't compare, think your diet's not working, and give up. Milk and soy clears up the fastest within weeks. Gluten takes 3 to 6 months or more. Now that said, you can see symptoms improve much sooner, long before the body's fully cleared of these actual foods. But that's how long it takes for them to be no longer in your system. You can make changes however it works best for you and your family. Some prefer to tackle everything at once and get it over with, the cold turkey transition. You want to see the results fast. And that's okay if you're willing to do the work and to go through a huge transition really fast, but sometimes that can also lead to a lot of backsliding and regression in mistakes being made because you're too overwhelmed at once. If you can handle it, that's great. If not, some prefer to focus on one item at a time. So right now we're going to work on gluten, figure out what it all means, and get rid of that. And then we'll move on to milk, and then to soy, and so on. Some people prefer to change one meal at a time. Right now we're going to focus on breakfast. Let's figure out how to get everything out of our breakfast that we no longer want to eat. And then after we conquer the breakfast meal, then we'll move on to lunch or snacks and so on. So whatever your method, be patient. The slower you transition, the longer it will take to see change. You want to make a list. This is very important. Highlight this. Make a list of symptoms that you have when you're starting, and then keep a daily food log and a symptom log. So you write down what time you're eating, what you're eating, and what kind of symptoms you're experiencing throughout the day. You do this as of the beginning of your diet. Now, the improvements that you may experience can sneak up on you, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, wait a minute, we're not experiencing this symptom anymore, or this behavior is gone. I don't remember that. And then you can look back over your food log and see, yes, on this day we had it, and as of this time, it's no longer been appearing. And so don't rely on your mental status or your memory to keep up. Really keep a record of what's going on, because this will be important as you continue on with the diet, and if you decide you want to, at a future point in time, try to reintroduce foods. But that's for a topic later. Now, another thing is that it could get worse before it gets better. Due to the addictive nature of these foods, symptoms might temporarily increase before they improve. Don't get worried. Don't be scared off about this. That will go away. So again, don't give up. Keep investigating to see if there are any other dietary changes that would continue improvement, such as the other diet options that are available. Be aware of those hidden ingredients and missed foods before you assume it's not working. And you want to be careful about cross-contaminating your allergen-free foods with crumbs, cooking utensils, use in other foods. And your list of previous symptoms comes in handy if you've been following the diet for a while with success and you think, oh, tonight I don't have time. Just this once, let's go get some takeout. That one holiday meal won't hurt. This time it's not going to matter. Remind yourself of what you and your child used to experience daily, because those memories might fade a little bit once you get into this new comfort zone of improved behaviors and symptoms. And this will kind of help you maintain your resolve on following the diet when these moments come up. Okay, and I'd like to move on now beyond the myths and talk about strategies that are helpful to make the diet work for you and your family. Again, it's one thing to say, well, this is what you need to do. These are helpful to try. But then once you start, you wonder, okay, how am I going to do this? Now, a way of sneaking healthy ingredients into your child's favorite foods is adding vegetable supplements, protein powders, or any of these things that are new. Add them into sauces or baked goods and smoothies and nut butters, things that they might not recognize right away. Be a sneaky mom. You want to start, key with this is starting with lower amounts and increase as you know they're tolerated. If you add so much that there's an obvious different flavor or texture or color or whatever it may be, your child, they'll pick up on that and they might resist it. So start with the lower amounts first and then increase. Another idea is having the whole family go on the diet at once. If you only have one child who needs this specific diet for autism, having the whole family do it once is much easier on the child. They'll be more compliant when there's not separate foods for that child. And there's less opportunity for sneaking food for the older child who has access or for cross-contamination. And this also could help other family members, unexpectedly, with a variety of different health problems. Another thing that is often related to these dietary issues are eczema and skin conditions, chronic ear infections, sinus problems. These types of issues often go away as well with the dietary changes, and often parents find that they have more energy and have a general healthier overall feeling if they follow the diet with their child. Now, on the other hand, a negative to this is that if you rely on packaged and processed gluten-free foods, then that will be more expensive. Now, if you choose the whole foods route and you're able to cook more of your foods, which is better all the way around for the nutrition quality and the nutrition content, you won't have so much of an increased expense with the gluten-free packaged foods. And another idea is just to make it fun and get your children involved. Some ideas are to start a garden. Children love growing things and experimenting with gardens, and if they can grow it and have that experience and pull it from the ground and bring it in and prepare it themselves, that's exciting, and they'll be much more likely to try something new with that whole experience behind it. Another idea is to have every week when you go grocery shopping with your child, one time, choose a new produce item to pick from the fruits and vegetables. And let your child pick a new item, make a big deal out of it that it's going to be an exciting adventure, and get them to try the new food, and they'll be more likely to experiment. It's more important to get your child to experiment with new foods than it is to try to get them to eat it all day, every day. What I mean by this is the more times your child is introduced to a food, even if they just take that one bite, the more likely they will eventually learn to like the food. The consistent reintroduction of the food, even if they reject it one time, is important. So get your children involved in preparing the food, and this, of course, will depend on their age, how much they can do, but the more they can do, the more they're most likely to eat it. And another idea is to make a list of each of your family members' favorite foods and see which ones you can easily adapt to the new diet with a few minor substitutions, because these are the easiest to incorporate into a new plan. And that brings me to another point, is that you want to learn how to plan a weekly menu. Being able to plan will save you a lot of stress and last minute, oh no, what's for dinner? And the takeout crises that may happen. No more quick runs through the drive-thru or takeout or delivery. So planning ahead will save you a lot of stress around that. And once you have a few family meals that you know your family likes, and this is actually quite simple to do, by making a list of your current favorites and then just tweaking them a little bit so that they fit the new plan. And simply rotate those for a couple of weeks, adding in a new recipe occasionally as you have time to try something new can help you expand your menu options easily. And you know, every family has an average of 5 to 10 recipes that they usually eat over and over again. So this is not out of the ordinary to have a menu plan like this. And then you can easily transfer this planning skill to preparing for trips away from home and having parties or being invited to a party, holidays, any time where you have to be away from home or you have to plan for your child's meal. It'll make life less stressful because you already know how to plan and you know how to be prepared. And the more you can plan ahead, the easier life will be on a day-to-day basis. And this is the end of the final strategies that I have planned out for this talk. And I think we can move on to the question and answer session.
Fantastic. That's really helpful. I think you give very, very practical suggestions. I see a lot of questions from parents on how to get their children to eat new foods. Carmelita says, she's a teacher. Carmelita says, my student doesn't like to eat any food except hot dogs. I've heard this over and over. They'll eat pizza, they'll eat beef patties. How do you introduce a child to a new food that's so resistant?
Picky eating can be actually have a combination of factors. It could be that there is a biological reason behind that. It's not necessarily a stubborn behavior issue. And with an imbalance in the biochemistry in the body, you could have actually a zinc deficiency. And when that happens, you have poor taste bud function, and your taste perception is off. And because of this, or there could also be an accumulation of toxic metals in the body, and that also alters your taste perception. So the key is to start with the supplements and the vitamins and minerals to kind of see if that's one of the factors that is contributing to the picky eating. And then beyond that, a lot of it could be related to the sensory needs. Maybe there's something that they're getting with the particular hot dog form or texture when they're chewing that food. And you can try with other foods that are similar in texture or similar in taste, so an alternative meat, perhaps chicken cut in the same form, if you have a cut hot dog, that is, small bite-sized pieces like that, to try to get something similar to it meeting the oral sensory needs. And if your child is just delayed because of the sensory delays, it doesn't necessarily mean that your child is ready for foods at that particular age. You kind of also have to think of your sensory age as well as your chronological age when you're introducing new foods. I'm not sure of the age that this one teacher said. I don't know how old the child is.
It didn't say.
Okay. I'm assuming if it's a teacher, probably elementary school at least, so not a younger child beginning new foods. But you want to see if there's something that has a sensory factor to it, or quite honestly, just continue to reintroduce. Like I said before, if you introduce new foods, they can be resisted over and over again, but the more you try, the easier it gets. One thing that we have in our particular home, and I have found that helps, that's really beneficial to a lot of families, has been the one bite rule. You don't have to eat it, but if you take one bite right now, then that's all you have to have. Some children will spit it out immediately. Some might lick it. You know, depending on how extreme their autistic symptoms and behaviors are or how high-functioning they are could depend on where you have to start with the one-bite rule. But if you start with that, they're getting consistently exposed to the texture and the flavor of this food. And the more exposures you have, the more likely they will learn to eventually eat it.
Now, you say this is about children, but let's see. Jody from Wisconsin has a son who is 24 and very adamant about making his own choices. How can she help him to direct him to eat better food?
Yes, for older children and adults, it's very important that you have their willingness and that they are on board with this. And I think a lot of what would help the most is just educating them in a non-pushy way. Bring it up on the side. Oh, well, look at this. Look what I'm reading about. This is interesting. This is what I've been reading about how diet can help us, and I'm kind of interested in trying this. Modeling the behavior yourself, making the changes yourself, is also very helpful. But the older children and adults, because they have the ability to make their own foods, purchase their own foods, possibly drive, they must be on board with this idea. And the only way you can start is by introducing the concepts to them, like I said, in this non-pushy way, and then step by step sort of introduce these ideas and say, hey, would you like to try this with me? The more they think it's their idea and they're in control of it, the more willing they'll be to make some changes.
Great, great advice. I have some questions here from, here's a question from Maria in Winkler. She says, her son, age 4, is suffering from constipation. I've tried dietary changes like fruits and vegetables and yogurt, and he's still not having a BM. He goes every 7 to 10 days.
Okay. The constipation could be a withholding factor. He could be holding in, and we need to make sure that that's not part of the problem. But with constipation, the digestive issues like this often signal the gluten, dairy, and soy digestive issues. And she should probably try to start there, remove these foods from the diet, and see if the constipation is relieved.
Now, would you suggest a remedy, a Miralax or some type of constipation remedy, or would you be looking at just the food standpoint?
That would have to come from a doctor's perspective. Anything that's prescribed from that point of view, I would really prefer to get a doctor's opinion on that. Mm-hmm. But if you can start with things like prune juice, carrot juice can also be a mild laxative, which are gentle and natural options. I prefer to look for natural options before choosing, of course, the pharmaceutical route, if possible, but that's not always possible. And if the child is going so long with withholding or with constipation, then it could be that a stronger intervention may be necessary. But quite often, simply the removal of those foods will relieve the constipation.
Very good, very good. I have a question here from a parent. I believe that you answered this before, but this bears repeating because this is a very important question. Deepak Paul from Abu Dhabi says, he asks the question, why do kids with autism prefer dairy products or casein foods?
Yes, absolutely. This does have to do with that opiate effect of these foods and the way that the brain, the receptors in the brain, These foods are similar to opioid compounds. And they literally have this drug-like effect within the body, and which means that they'll be craved repeatedly. And when you take these foods away, the craving is stronger, which is another reason why the behaviors can temporarily increase before they go away, and it's quite normal. But it's a little bit difficult, and that's why that's why I started Nourishing Journey, because it's a transition that you have to go through. And once you get outside the transition and on what I call on the other side of transition, where you've got a regular routine, it's easy. But first you have to get through that craving time. You have to get through the moment when you're telling your child, no, you can't have all of these favorites that you have once had, and we're going to change things. But
that must
once,
be very distressing to a child to hear. More cookies.
Well, we don't want to tell them like that.
You can have gluten, casein-free cookies.
Right. And actually, there are a lot of healthy alternatives using fresh fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds that you might not even be aware of, not think about, or almond-based flours or gluten-free flours that don't even have sugar added to them, that are alternatives to the sweets. I find that the sweets are the easiest to replace with healthy alternatives than other things like fried foods and breads, because they're a bit different. That's just my opinion. I find the sweets are one of the easier things to replace. But there is this transition period, and they do crave these foods because it is this addictive property within the body, with these foods that they have.
Yes, absolutely. I want to take a moment here to remind the audience, if you're dialing in, you can press *2 on your phone to raise your hand, and if you raise your hand, I will call on you like any good teacher. I will call on you if you raise your hand. I'll try to get to everybody who has questions today. I don't see any questions. I don't see the hands up, but I'm looking. Okay, we had a couple of questions about probiotics. Let me see if I can. This person said, this is kind of a two-part question too. Chantella from Torrance says, "Hello, I see a lot of people using the gluten-free diet because Jenny McCarthy swears by it, but my son has never been medicated. I put vitamins with DHA and omegas to help him stay focused, and he's been doing well in middle school. What can gluten-free do for my 14-year-old as opposed to medication?"
Okay. The gluten-free, along with the other casein and soy foods, to eliminate those from the diet, you're going to see a reduction of symptoms like the staring off into space, the inability to speak, the anger and aggression, rage, things like that can all be, it's really a variety of symptoms have been shown to be reduced or even eliminated through the the introduction of this diet.
On the same note, this is a similar question. Robert from Las Cruces says, "Now let's talk about behavior. When my son gets agitated, he starts to hit himself, especially his head, and also yells very loud. I have him wear his helmet when he hits himself. He also has bad breath when he's agitated. I'd like to know more about that. I've been trying to move him to a gluten-free diet and also started him on omega-3 fish oils and probiotics. This change seems to be calming him down, and he had fewer outbursts. My question is, does a change in diet really have an effect on their behavior?"
Absolutely. And it all goes back to the opioid peptides, those short chain of proteins that are too large to be getting into the bloodstream in a normal, healthy digestive system. And they're now, because of the leaky gut problem, getting through. These compounds, these opioid peptides, besides being addicting, which we've already discussed, they can cause this behavior, like the silly spacey behavior, the inattention and mood changes, the self-injury, the aggression, some of these things I've already mentioned. And they are all extremely tied to these particular proteins and the inability of the body to digest them with this poor functioning digestive tract. So these diets, what they do is they help by first eliminating those triggers and at the same time putting in the stuff that's going to help rejuvenate the digestive tract and fix it. The probiotics, I mentioned before that they actually start to plug the holes within the digestive tract. Our body needs a certain type of bacteria, which we call the good gut bacteria. And then if, for example, with the use of antibiotics are non-discriminative. They will go in and clear out the body of any kind of bacteria, good or bad. And when that happens, the gut flora is then replaced with these bad bacteria coming back in and expanding because there are not enough colonies of the good bacteria to resist it. And that's how there is an overabundance of the bad bacteria in the body, and the byproducts of these bad bacteria and their metabolism also gets into the bloodstream as toxins and can also contribute to the worsening of the behaviors. So it's kind of a twofold problem with the opioid peptides and the toxins from these things. And once the digestive system is out of whack, I mean, it just opens the pathway for other things that you don't want in the body to start to grow, the yeast and the parasites and the various bad bacteria and fungi and all of these things that can contribute to behaviors in their own unique ways. So it's actually very, very complicated process.
Yes.
So.
Yes, and here's another complicated, I'm not sure what the difference between, you know, probiotic and fermented food is, but Asiya wants to know from Riyadh, how much probiotic/fermented foods is encouraged for a diet for autistic children. Her son sometimes eats pickles, but this time she can't give him fermented food, so she supplements with probiotic. So I think what she's trying to say is it okay if he won't eat the pickles to supplement with probiotics, and how much probiotics is recommended for a child with autism?
Right. Probiotics are actually entirely different from the fermented foods. They help with the fermented foods are, they contribute some of the healthy bacteria. That's why we eat them. Probiotics are basically a manufactured version of this. And it is okay to supplement with probiotics. Many of these diets, like starting with the gluten-free, casein-free, soy-free diet, it's a mouthful, starting with that one, they don't even mention fermented foods. It's when you get into those specific diets that were on that list earlier on. The body ecology diet is one that really focuses on the fermented foods and the special food combining to get rid of yeast.
Gotcha. I'm thinking myself, I don't know how you would get a child to eat fermented foods. I'm impressed that this woman's child eats pickles.
You know, like I said, the fermented foods are not your only option. You can use probiotics as an alternative. A lot of kids, it depends on what sensory issues they may be having around food or what their taste preferences are. You know, I find it interesting, just as a little anecdotal thing from my own family, my youngest daughter, she was my fourth, and by that time with the pregnancies, I was eating the foods that I enjoyed, even though they said, oh, you shouldn't eat spicy foods or this or that. I ate spicy foods with my last pregnancy because I love spicy food, and she loves spicy food, and I find it interesting that she does. Even as a young baby, young child, she would always try to eat my food and would not shy away from the spicy stuff. She'd go grab more. So I know that the more they're exposed to it at an earlier age, the more likely they're actually to eat those things. Which is why I'm constantly saying exposure, exposure, exposure. Better one bite than not at all because they resisted it one time. So if you do want to continue trying with more fermented foods, then keep trying. It's the simplest way to put it.
Yes, I've heard that no means no right now. That's something that Ron actually said. No means no right now, but you try again at a later that day, the next day.
Absolutely.
Since we're talking about our children exposing them to foods, I have to ask you a personal question regarding my own son. My son, Kyle, is 7, and he actually has a gag reflex. If he sees fruits or vegetables, he actually gags. His teacher tried to get him to just hold a strawberry, and he threw up, literally. I'm like, wow, talk about an aversion to fruits and vegetables. Now, aside from, you know, the exposure to it, can you talk anything about the gag reflex and what that is and why it happens, and is there anything that we could do about that?
Well, the gag reflex is coming from the sensory side. Something is causing this reflex, and it could be from different things in different children, but something that you could do about it would be trying not just holding. Could he handle the smell sensation without the visual, without viewing
it? It might be the smell. That's an interesting point. So you're saying to separate the sight and the smell and see what's causing the gag reaction.
Yes, separate the senses. Could he put his hand in the bag without looking at it and touch it, and would the gag reflex be there? If you could pinch his nose and have him taste it, would the gag reflex be there? Of course, without seeing it, would the gag reflex be there?
Right.
So try to isolate the senses and to see which one is causing it, and then you can try to create a plan of trying to reintroduce it based on what sense is the issue.
Yeah, it seems to be even visual. They tell me he throws up from, you know, things being red and wet. You know, it's like, apparently there's a lot of factors, of course, to sensory issues that, you know, that you have many senses, and it's hard to sometimes, you know, isolate that. So that was a very good suggestion. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I was just thinking about is the possibility of putting it into a smoothie.
Yeah, if only he would drink a smoothie.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes the smooth textures only, sometimes it's chunky textures only, sometimes it's no mixing. I understand that. Smoothies can be ideal for getting a lot of nutrition in our kids, especially green smoothies. I love, love, love green smoothies. Throw in some frozen or fresh fruits and vegetables with a handful of greens, and you've got a power-packed nutrition snack or meal for a child or adult, doesn't matter. We love smoothies in our home. As a matter of fact, we've called them moosies. that came from my third child when she was a baby. She was my moosie girl.
Very nice. I wish my kids would eat that. I would throw all kinds of fruits and vegetables in there, and hopefully it wouldn't come out back out looking the same way it went in. I have a very interesting question here from Monica in Pasadena. This may be, I don't know how this is related. She asks, when kids start getting seizures, does their diet change? I think what she's trying to say is you change their diet if they have seizures.
Well, seizures are entirely, well, I wouldn't say entirely different, because as we'll find out in one of the other webinars, they can be related to autism. But what I'm speaking about tonight is directly related to autism and ADHD and these sensory issues with the digestive. There's a possibility that these types of diets would help for seizures as well. It would depend on what kind of nutritional imbalances did you say it was a child who had seizures?
Yeah, and I'm assuming, she just asked a general question, when kids start getting seizures. I'm assuming she means autistic children, because this is,
okay,
you know, an autism seminar. So, you know, there's a lot of children on the spectrum are prone to seizures, and I think what she might be trying to ask is there a connection between the seizures and diet?
Well, that is something that's a little bit outside of my experience. I have not personally worked with a family who has a child with seizures, so I can't attest to what I have experienced or helped a family with.
Oh, okay. Well, just thought I'd throw that out there. They are two quite different issues.
They are. Perhaps the topic coming up tomorrow on more biomedical strategies would be a good place to ask this question. You know, that's one thing. The diet is just one part of the biomedical intervention strategy. So.
Absolutely. Kids and taking pills. Sharon from Flushing would like to know. My son would, this is actually maybe a 2 or 3 part question. Sharon from Flushing said, my son ate everything up until the age of 2. Then he limited himself to a few food items, chicken cutlets, peanut butter, pizza, and canned tuna, which they switched to canned chicken. That sounds like the typical autism diet. My question is, how do you get your child to improve his nutrition if he won't eat anything else or swallow pills? He chews a multivitamin, and he also has a sensory integration disorder along with high-functioning autism, OCD, anxiety disorder, and auditory processing disorder. We've tried working with a holistic nutritionist, but we couldn't continue for a few reasons. Now, in that case where there's so many different factors going on, would this be something for a holistic nutritionist to answer, do you think?
Well, I could give my suggestions on how to increase the nutrients in the diet and let's start with the pill. I'm stumbling over my words here.
Yeah, I can't imagine getting a kid to swallow a pill either, but people do it.
Yeah. Well, what about crushing the pill?
Mm-hmm.
And mixing it with the food that they will eat, with the canned chicken or the other foods. I can't remember if there was anything with that list of foods. Was there anything creamy or liquid in some way?
Peanut butter, pizza.
Peanut butter, yes.
Yeah.
Peanut butter is perfect.
Perfect, especially the chunky kind. Yeah,
good.
I guess a lot of parents are asking the same thing. How do you get your child to improve his nutrition if you won't eat anything else? I hear this just every single day. My child will only eat this. My child will only eat beige food and dry food. Don't give him anything wet. You know, he'll gag. You know, white rice, French fries, plain pasta, it horrifies me. But it's very difficult. You know, I think that what you said before about that just first holding it and then maybe licking it, taking a bite, spitting it out. Aside from that, is there any other things that you could think of offhand that might help us get some different foods into our children? I know you've already addressed that question, but is there anything like specifically when you have a child who just will not put it in his mouth?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is that there's not just one or two foods that they have to have. There are so many foods that they can have, so many different types of fruits and vegetables and meals that you can prepare. I think we get so focused on the few that they won't eat, it feels like it's everything. But when we're focusing on a few things, continue trying something new. And quite honestly, as the parents in the house, we control what comes into the house. And it's a very scary thought to say, but my child won't eat anything else. If I don't buy this, my child will starve. Now, there have been the rarer cases, I could say, where a child really, really will go without food to his own detriment. But you have to figure out if your child will, if you let your child eat something else because they won't eat what you're giving them, then they're going to learn that I can have what I want next time.
As long as I hold out long enough, right?
As long as I hold out long enough, exactly.
So that being said, how long do you think would be a dangerous? I mean, I think once we got to 3 days with my son, we caved in and gave him the French fries. What do you think is a reasonable amount of time to wait for a child to eat something else if they won't eat anything but a certain list of foods?
Well, let me ask you this. With the 3 days and the French fries, were you trying anything else besides one specific food, or what were you trying?
Oh, exposure. You said it before. You have to expose them to things. And, you know, some things he'd gag at, other things he would get up from the table if we put it in front of him. He was very intolerant even. You know, it took a long time for us to get him for me to sit next to him if I had something different on my plate than he had. He was so resistant. So I guess what my question was is, you know, yes, you would offer a child something different for every meal, correct? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. if the child only you have this for breakfast, have that for lunch, you wouldn't just keep introducing the same food, right? Or other people have told me that you stick with one food. What is your opinion on that?
Well, sticking with one food can cause more of a power play.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion. So I'm not going to eat this one food and you're not going to make me. And of course, I'm not saying that that's what the child is thinking, but it could turn into that. This is the one and only food I'm going to give you. This is the one and only food I'm not going to eat.
Exactly, yes.
Right.
It does often work that way.
Yeah, so you want to consistently introduce a variety of foods that you're okay with your child having. And if you're trying to stop the French fries, of course, if they're homemade French fries, if you take a potato, you slice it up, drizzle some olive oil over it and salt and put it in the oven and bake it like an oven fry,
mm-hmm.
that's a possible alternative.
Maybe not,
but it's a possible alternative to try. Something similar. And if it's still about the French fries, then at that point, you want to give your child something else you know that they like.
Right.
Because that's acceptable. Right now, you're working on the French fries, or perhaps the macaroni and cheese, or the, you know, whatever it may be.
Well, so you're saying replace one food at a time rather than trying to change their whole diet and not give them anything to eat. Am I correct? Is that what you're saying?
If that's the method that works best for you and your child, it depends on how extreme the sensory issues are around eating. And it depends on how high-functioning the child is or how old mm-hmm. the child is. It's really, really hard to give a blanket answer because it's such a unique process. What
yes.
one child will eat, another one won't. It's the same with us as adults.
Yes, very much so. Very much
my,
so.
Yeah, my children would probably gag at the thought of eating lima beans because they've never been exposed to it. Why? I hate lima beans, so I've never made them.
Maybe they would love them.
Maybe they would love them, exactly. It's just one of those things that I thought about, well, I've never made that. Or black-eyed peas. I've never made those. But you know what? There's a whole different variety of legumes out there that my children have eaten and they will eat. And they're not missing anything by not having that one thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so if you really are coming down to an extended period of time when your child's not eating anything because you're not giving them that one food, maybe back off of the whole you can't have any of the favorites anymore. That one thing we're going to get rid of. Maybe we're not going to get rid of all gluten right now. Maybe right now we're going to get rid of the macaroni and cheese. But I will give my child chicken nuggets if that's what they want. I will give my child French fries from McDonald's if that's what they want because those also have gluten on them. They dust them with flour.
I've heard a lot of packaged French fries are, too. They don't list that. How would you know if a packaged French fry has been dusted or not?
If it's a packaged French fry in a store, it has to be listed on the label. Those are required.
Okay.
That's required. But it's restaurants where you don't know.
Oh, I see. Very good.
Yeah.
I want to recommend once again, I want to remind the callers once again, if you're dialing in and you have a question for Stephanie, please raise your hand by pressing *2 on your phone, and we would love to hear from you. It would be very nice to hear some people from the audience now. That being said, let's go back to our questions. And
can I jump in here and mention something?
Absolutely. Please do.
Okay. Yeah, I've got one more page here on the slides. I just wanted to mention, we discussed this before, I've actually put together something pretty special for Autism Awareness Month. there is a giveaway that I'm hosting called Success Strategies for the Autism Spectrum. And I have gathered 13 experts and service providers. I'm one of them who's giving away a gift about the autism and ADHD diet. And there, it's a variety of gifts that are being given away, from legal documents to handle information video series, EFT and how to use that for your child, sound approach, quite a variety
that
from these 13
fantastic.
Different experts.
Sounds fantastic. How can they get this?
Well, if you go to www.freeresourcesforautism.com, the giveaway is open through the 18th. So if you register now, you still have until the 18th to be able to download all of those gifts. And it's not anything you have to win. If you register, you get access to each and every gift provided.
That sounds fantastic. Maybe you can give us a link to that, or actually let's just write that down. Let me ask you to say that one more time for people to write down. Stephanie is hosting a giveaway of all sorts of autism resources of all types, and it looks fantastic. It just looks like a fantastic resource. And can you please give us that website again?
Sure. It's on the screen now, and the website address is www.freeresourcesforautism.com.
That's fantastic. That's really great thing for you to do for these parents who are working so hard to help their children. Now, let me switch. I just a whole bunch of questions just poured in, so I'd like to just continue
sure.
to ask some more. This is a very interesting question. From Chris from Seattle wants to know, other than trial and error in diet, are there other ways of testing for leaky gut in children with ASD?
Testing for leaky gut, specifically, I wouldn't say, but there are food allergies and sensitivity tests. I actually just wrote about this quite in depth on my blog, nourishingjourney.com. I don't want to send you there to go to look for the information, but I covered all of the different types of tests that are available. There is a difference between food allergy and food sensitivity or intolerance. Food allergies are measured in the IgE response for the immune system, for the antibodies that are measured, and food intolerances are measured more in the IgG antibody measurements. And there are benefits and drawbacks to all of this type of testing. The IgE is the standard medical testing. So if you go to a doctor and say, I think I may have allergies, they're thinking in the IgE sense of the word, that usually involves breaking out in hives, closing of the throat and airways, this intense anaphylactic shock type of reaction, which could be mild with just the hives, or it could be into a life-threatening situation. This is what they're more familiar with in the standard medical doctor testing world, I should say, but more mm-hmm. on the naturopath side and the alternative side, there are other testing which tests for IgG testing and general food insensitivities and food sensitivities and intolerances.
mm-hmm.
And these tests. There's the RAS, the Alcott, Alcat test, a variety of different measurements and tests that they can take. And there are benefits and drawbacks to all of these testing. Some of them can give you a false positive. Some of them can give you a false negative. Also true with the IgE testing. The only way to 100% truly know that this is a problem for you or your child is to do an elimination diet. And a doctor will tell you the same. This is what we think is wrong. You can eliminate it and come back and tell us your results.
Very good.
Yeah. Of course, if you have a reaction that's more of the life-threatening side, you don't
then
want to test
it.
We won't be
Let's
testing
Let's give my
those.
Child peanuts and see if he dies, okay?
Exactly. We don't need to test those. Those are the obvious ones. But, you know, I have to say that. So,
of course.
You test the milder reactions or what you think are the food sensitivities or intolerances you have.
Very good. Here's something very interesting. SBR from Milford, she's currently, looks like she's asking a question about herself. She's currently on a gluten-free, casein-free, soy-free, whole foods diet and looking for healthy, high-calorie items to enhance weight, to enhance the weight of her teen. She gives her lots of olive oil to increase calories. She wants to know, should I try a protein supplement? And if so, can you suggest any products as I have had difficulty finding a protein supplement that is gluten-free and casein-free?
I would recommend a hemp protein supplement. Those are my personal favorites. Hemp is a super high-quality protein. And I know some people think hemp, think marijuana, the illegal kind. But the protein in hemp protein supplements comes from the seed. Perfectly legal. Nothing wrong with it.
Okay. Let's just make sure we're giving them the right kind of hemp. Yes, okay.
Yeah, yes. No. What's available? Hemp milk, hemp protein powders, those are definitely the right kind. They are produced from the seeds of the hemp plant, like I said, and it's a very healthy alternative for milk, but it also contains high protein and quality source of protein. Hemp is just one of my favorites. It's also high in vitamins A, D, E, B12, B2, folic acid. It's got calcium, magnesium, potassium, phosphorus, iron, zinc, all of these things that you think,
wow.
Oh, my kids are deficient in. Hemp is one of the miracle foods, I think, as far as
sure,
the
sounds like a miracle food. Yeah.
Quality of it. Yeah. So if you could search for hemp protein powder, then that would be my top suggestion. Another one of these wonder foods that I love is from coconut. So you can use coconut water, which is the liquid. And so this isn't the protein side of it or high calorie side of it, but the liquid in the coconut, just the water itself, is a natural electrolyte solution. And it's better than any sports drink that's out there. And if it's actually so close to the blood electrolyte levels in our bloodstream that during World War II, when they were low on blood supplies, they actually used coconut water as IV infusion instead of blood plasma. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. So it's very healthy for us. Not only do you get the coconut water, but from the young coconuts, there's this jelly-like substance in it that turns into the hard flesh of a ripe, mature coconut. And this is full of enzymes and nutrients and fiber and minerals as well. And coconut milk is made from squeezing the grated flesh. And the coconut milk, you can also ferment into kefir or yogurt. So that's an alternative to dairy products. And this is another thing with the fermented yogurt. That's a good probiotic source, coconut milk yogurt. So this helps with the bacteria, the probiotic source, and regenerating the intestinal flora. And it's also just high-quality nutrients. Coconut oil, I would suggest, instead of olive oil, use coconut oil. And this is pure, unrefined coconut oil, so not hydrogenated, please. No trans fats in it. A while back, coconut oil got a bad name because all the tests they ran on it were using hydrogenated coconut oil.
I see. I did not know that.
Aha, yeah, and so that is, so it kind of got a bad rap, and they're now rediscovering how healthy it actually is. It's one of the most stable oils that you can use to cook in high heat, and it won't go rancid. Coconut oil has also been shown to improve Alzheimer's symptoms. A couple of tablespoons, I believe, was the amount a day, increases memory and brain function in Alzheimer's patients. It's just the coconut oil is one of those healthy fats that's really good for our brain. Plus, it'll add those calories and provide more nutrients than olive oil would. And it tastes better.
Yeah, I would think so. Quick question from Donna. Kombucha is a probiotic. Do you know of it, and do you advocate for it?
Yes, it is. It's just one of those. It's one of the many options. And mm-hmm. whatever probiotics and fermented foods that you can get your child to take is a good option. So that's my opinion
there.
On it.
Yeah. I agree with that. I have to take this question from, I hope I'm saying it right, Gleda Silva. She's been asking these great questions all day. She asks, she's from Oki. I'm not giving it any justice here. So Gleda Silva wants to know, what can you say about a child who is 2 years old and loves to eat and he can eat all day long and anything? He's not overweight, but his mother is worried about him getting diabetes.
Okay. Well, that would just depend on what the child is actually eating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're eating healthy foods, you know, from that list that I gave earlier on, they're not eating constantly the bread products, the sugars, the creams, the all of these things that you want to eliminate on this particular diet. Did she say whether or not this child has autism?
I assume that all these children they're speaking about do have autism, but I don't. She didn't specify.
Okay, it wasn't specified, so I'm wondering if it just might be another topic she's bringing up. Whether or not the child needs the gluten-free, dairy-free, soy-free diet for autism, if your child is eating a variety of healthy foods, the healthy fats, the fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, good sources of protein, and they're not eating junk foods, processed foods, artificial additives, things like that, then I don't think that there's any concern with your child coming down with diabetes.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. They're not going to get diabetes from fruits, well, maybe fruits, but vegetables and healthy foods. Switching gears here. Actually, this is a very interesting question. There's two very interesting questions. We have only about 15 minutes left, so maybe you can just give me some quick hits on some of these. I have had my son on a gluten cast. I believe you answered this question before, but it bears repeating. I've had my son on a gluten-free, casein-free diet since December, and I've seen tremendous improvement on his behaviors. I've met a lot of resistance from my pediatrician, so I ask you, do you suggest a calcium supplement since he doesn't get it from dairy? Now, you mentioned before leafy green vegetables for calcium. What else can you suggest?
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of foods that are high in calcium. Almonds are high in calcium. Sesame is very, very high in calcium. The nuts and the seeds, besides the green leafy vegetables, the seaweeds, I'm at a loss for the word here,
yeah.
Sea vegetables like nori and dulse and kemp. These sea vegetables, seaweeds, they have a very high calcium source. So there's actually a variety of calcium supplements in our foods, so to say. I call it supplements, but calcium sources within our foods without needing a calcium supplement. What I will say is that magnesium is very important for the assimilation of calcium. And if you're going to give a supplement for calcium, or if you're concerned about the calcium content for your child's diet, ensure that they're also getting high-quality sources of magnesium as well, because magnesium is necessary for proper calcium absorption.
That's good to know.
And hemp also. Hemp was one of those others that's very, very high in calcium. Salmon and sardines are also fish sources that are high in calcium.
So can you just tell us briefly what it sounds as if you're saying that, you know, if you are eating, you know, the right foods, you don't need to supplement. What is your view on supplements in general? What type of things that you can't get from food or can't get in big amounts from food might you suggest supplements using as supplements?
Well, first of all, when the children are coming into this new diet, there is obviously a digestive system imbalance. And most of these children have nutrient deficiencies. So yes, I do recommend supplementation. I often will say start with the foods that you're eating. If you can get it into the diet in a natural form in the foods, that's making every bite count. That's power packing the nutrition from your diet, which is where we're supposed to get it from to begin with. But that said, we are starting with vitamin and nutrient deficiencies. So supplementation is beneficial and quite often necessary. Not only that, but again, with our modern world and the agriculture of today, the soils have been stripped from the nutrients and the foods are not organically grown unless you have the ability and the resources to be able to get organic foods near you. Even the organic foods don't have the content of the minerals and the nutrients that they used to have because of the soils being stripped of a lot of nutrients. So that, with all of this combined, yes, the bottom line is that supplements are beneficial, but you don't want to go to the grocery store and pick up the cheapest bottle of supplements there. You want to supplement specifically these vitamins and minerals that are commonly deficient in children with autism, like calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, zinc. These nutrients are very, very important, but you want to have a high-quality supplement, especially if you're following this elimination diet, because you want to be sure that they don't have gluten, casein, and soy in it.
Right,
because then
of course. You're
defeating the purpose of supplementation there. So,
now, I've heard some people, when I would go, some salespeople telling me that liquid supplements are more readily available, better for, you know, when you're supplementing for children, that it's more readily available to get them in liquid form. What's your opinion on that than in pill form, you know, liquid rather than pill?
No, it depends. I don't say that liquid or pill form is better than the other. It comes down to the manufacturing process of the vitamins. You want to make sure that the vitamins themselves are readily available, and they can be readily assimilated, is what I mean. And that does not mean that it has to be in liquid form. In a way, liquid form would be more quickly digested, but it does not mean that the body would not digest the pill just as well with a tiny bit more time.
Good answer. Good answer.
Does that make sense the way I
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
We only have about 8 more minutes, so I want to remind the callers, if you're dialing in, I still don't see any hands up. I'd love to hear from some people in our audience. So if you're dialing in, all you need to do is press star 2, and I will put you on the phone with Stephanie. There was a question that I really wanted to get to. That was a little bit of a change on. Still in the range of supplementations. I know this is not really your expertise per se, but I've heard about B12 so much, and Donna from Illinois wants to know, what's your opinion on B12 for those with autism?
Yeah, B12 is also another good supplement, but I would say this is for the general population overall. B12 is actually... with the cleaning of our foods, we're washing away all of the dirt and the soil residues. And we get a lot of B12 from that if we didn't wash it away. And so in the general population, I think that even if you are not a vegetarian, this is generally B12 is a vegetarian issue. I need to supplement if I don't eat meat. Because the thing is that the animals are getting the B12, and then we eat the animals, and then therefore we get the B12 from the animals. But even that said, it's commonly found that people are generally deficient in B12, and it's a good, it's also good to be supplementing with as well. I mentioned that in the list.
Right. As far as how you give B12, I've heard doctors say, to me personally, it's better to inject the B12 than to have the child ingest it. And what's your opinion on that?
The question again, it's better to what
inject,
versus?
Inject. I had a band doctor who thought it would be better to inject a child with B12 rather than have him eat it. I opted not to do that because I didn't like the idea of injecting my child with anything. But do you know if there's any benefit to it being given to the body that way or by being ingested? Is there any, what's the difference? What's the benefit?
I think the difference with that would be it would go directly into the bloodstream as opposed to having to be digested along with the whatever else may be in the stomach at the same time, but there is also sublingual B12 where you can put drops under your tongue, and then that will be more quickly assimilated as well. There's a sublingual variety it's called. And then there's a difference between cyanocobalamin and, methylcobalamin. Sorry. There are two different kinds of B12, and the one that begins with cyanocobalamin is the one that's better assimilated by the body, and that's a better choice. So, but as far as injecting, unless the doctor had one specific reason why that was the better choice at the time, I couldn't give you an answer one way or the other with that, because there is, the sublingual type. But again, when it's injected, it does get straight into the bloodstream as opposed to going through the digestive system first. And if it goes through the digestive system and you have an improperly functioning digestive tract, it might not be absorbed because that's the whole problem.
I think that's what he was saying. I think that was the reason. Thank you for answering that question. That makes a lot of sense. Too much of a good thing. Tammy from Lexington says, can you give too much fish oil to a child? She was thinking about giving cod liver oil. Can you give too much fish oil to a child?
There's always too much of a good thing. You would just go with the recommended amount for the child's age, whatever is recommended on the bottle. I don't think that there's any necessity for over-prescribing any particular thing unless... There are some reasons why you would give extra vitamin D, for example. There is the daily recommended allowance for vitamin D, but doctors generally say, will say that you need much more vitamin D than what the standard daily allowance is. And in that case, it would be more. But for the omega-3s and the fatty acids, do what's been prescribed or recommended for you because there's no need in going over that.
Right, just briefly, we're almost out of time, but do you recommend, Tammy is saying cod liver oil. Is there any particular type? I know there's a whole bunch of different fish oils, different omega oils. Can you recommend one that would be best for children with autism?
The quality of the omega-3 versus the omega-6, you want to make sure that the omega oil that you're having is not diluted or that you're using is not diluted with omega-6 oils in it. The higher the omega-6 count in the mixture will lower the quality of the oil that you're giving. Krill oil, because there are two different types, omega-6 and omega-3s. Omega-3s are the ones that are found in the fish. It's also found in flaxseed and some other plant sources. But the omega-6 oils are what's used too much in our diets today, which is why we need to supplement with omega-3s, because we're getting too much of these processed foods that's full of corn oil, sunflower oil, canola oil, all of these vegetable oils. And that's too much, and it's getting our body out of balance. We need omega-3 fats for a healthy brain function, which is why it is so commonly prescribed. It's a supplement for kids with autism and ADHD. Yes, so as far as the quality of the oil goes, I know krill oil is one of the latest that's been stated as having the best quality. You want to make sure that you're getting your oil from a non-mercury contaminated source. That's the biggest one, because fish can be contaminated with mercury, and heavy metals are one of the contributing factors in autism and the symptoms. We want to get rid of the heavy metal contamination and avoid that kind of exposure.
That's excellent. Very good. That was very good. Very nice to clarify. And the omega-9s, we're really out of time, but I always see omega-3, 6, 9. What's the deal with the 9 in a nutshell?
The omega-9s your body can produce. So the omega-3s omega-3s, your body, it's essential. You must get that from your diet. And they're very, very important.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, that really made a lot of sense. That really clarified things for me. Thank you so much. We're about out of time, but I would like to know if you would like to wrap it up. Do you have anything else to tell the audience? Anything else you want to share with us?
Well, the only other thing I would say is if you are looking for more help, and if you have a very specific question that you would like to have answered, then, you know, that's what I'm here for. You can visit my website, learn more about how to contact me at nourishingjourney.com. I have a brand new program out called Food Elimination Made Easy, and it goes into step-by-step instructions with videos, audio or written transcripts of these videos, where it breaks down all of this confusing information into step-by-step pieces, going into the full details of the gluten and dairy and soy-free eating, artificial eating, reading food labels, managing the diet at school. And if you'd like to learn more about that program, it's foodeliminationmadeeasy.com. Otherwise, I would love for you to visit the giveaway. Read my articles on my blog. I try to give more information.